Surah 70 from Mecca. It's another surah on judgment. Hell is described here as a churning fire ripping away the scalp. So if you're interested in a hellfire sermon, the New Testament can be abused that way, but the Quran gives you plenty of images. You should be able to make a good sermon out of it. The Redemptorists have, of course, reformed. But God bless them. But there was a time when they were really into this. In fact, it helped the MSCs, because our MSC early missionaries went around, Father Maloney and many others, went around these country towns, and people would come to a mission. I mean, this is... And they couldn't believe it. They were... I don't know if I want to finish this. They were hearing that God is love. Anyhow, back to the Quran. Surah 71. It's clear from the way the story of Noah is told in this surah that Muhammad sees himself as carrying on the prophetic mission of Noah. Those who reject Muhammad's revelation will suffer the same consequences as the contemporaries of Noah. 72. It refers to the jinn, these elemental spirits of a lower order than the angels. Do jinn exist? I don't know. I mean, once you get beyond our empirical world, angels, do angels exist? Or I don't know, actually, but why not? So we're into a pretty vague area of theology here. And by the way, the ideas of devils and angels are not found in the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures. The angel of the Lord in Hebrew is God, spoken of while preserving God's transcendence. The angels and devils came from Zoroastrianism, again, came from the East. And by New Testament times, everyone's consciousness is full of angels and devils, as your conscience may still be. I don't know. Anyhow, this is about the jinn. And some of these jinn were being enlightened by Muhammad, and they converted to Islam. I don't know what empirical evidence you'd have of that, but that's what the Quran says. Verse 23, whoever disobeys God and his messenger, his shall be the fire of hell, abiding therein forever. Verse 26, Noah of the unseen, he does not disclose his unseen to anyone, save to the one whom he approves as a messenger. Then he dispatches before him and behind him a guard, that he may know that they have indeed conveyed the message of the Lord. And he encompasses whatever is with them and keeps a numbered account of all things. Surah 73 from Mecca describes how Muhammad rose from a bed and wrapped himself in a cloak to carry out a vigil. I'll have more to read to you about that in a moment. Surah 74 from Mecca. Some claim this was Muhammad's first experience of receiving words from God. Others claim this for another surah. It's a warning to those who do not believe on the Day of Judgment. Psalm 75 is about the power of God to raise the dead. Verse 22. Faces that day shall be radiant, gazing upon their Lord. And faces that day shall be scowling, knowing that a spine-crushing calamity will befall them. Surah 76. Commentators suggest that this surah was revealed when Muhammad's family were fasting having given their food to the indigent, the orphan, and the captive. It speaks, as do many of these shorter surahs, of divine judgment. Verse 30, truly God is knowing, wise. He causes whomsoever he will to enter into his mercy. And as for the wrongdoers, he has prepared for them a painful punishment. Surah 77 from Mecca, verse 37. Woe the day to the deniers. This is the day of judgment. I was tempted to skip a lot of these surahs because they're nearly all about hell. But I guess there we are. I thought I've got to be fair. I'll do my best to summarise each of them. Surah 78. Again, it's about the day of judgment, and it speaks also of the blessings of paradise. Verse 31. Truly, the reverent shall have a place of triumph. And here it defines what it is. Gardens and vineyards, buxom maidens of like age, and an overflowing cup. Verse 40. Truly, we have warned you of a punishment. Of a punishment night on a day when a man beholds what his hands have sent forth. And the disbeliever says, oh, would that I were dust. Looking back over his life and realising how much folly there's been in it to face God's judgment. Surah 79 speaks of those being wrested from the love of what is other than God. It's another surah on the day of judgment. Verse 37, for one who rebels and prefers the life of this world, truly hellfire is the refuge. For one who fears standing before his Lord and forbids the soul from caprice, truly the garden is their refuge. The garden, of course, paradise. Surah 80 from Mecca. Faces that day shall be shining, radiant, laughing, joyous. And faces that day shall be covered with dust, overspread with darkness. Those, they are the disbelievers, the profligates. Surah 81 from Mecca. It's another surah on judgment and the necessity to listen to Muhammad. Verse 19 speaks of Muhammad's vision of a noble messenger possessed of strength before the possessor of the throne of high rank. And that's interpreted as Gabriel, who was the one who, because God is above all this, Gabriel's the one God chose to reveal the Quran from heaven to Muhammad. Psalm 82, again, I'm not giving it all to you here, obviously, but it's about the day of judgment. Verse 13, truly the pious shall be in bliss, and truly the profligate shall be in hellfire, burning therein on the day of judgment. Psalm 83 is again on judgment. Psalm 84 likewise on the day of judgment. Psalm 85 verse 10 reads, truly those who persecute believing men and believing women then do not repent, theirs shall be the punishment of hell. And theirs shall be the punishment of the burning Truly, those who believe and perform righteous deeds, theirs shall be the gardens with rivers running below. That is the supreme triumph. You can see how much the hereafter will dominate the Quran. Psalm 86, verse 17, Muhammad is told, be gentle with the disbelievers. Grant them respite for a while. That's from Mecca. It stands in stark contrast to the advice, the words given him in Medina. Surah 87, verse 15 is a call to remember the name of the Lord, the Most High, Allah, and pray. Verse 88 from Mecca speaks of the fate of those who believe and those who disbelieve. Muhammad is sent to warn them. And Surah 89, verse 17 speaks of the fate of those who honour not the orphan and urge not the feeding of the indigent and devour inheritance with rapacious devouring and love wealth with abounding love. Surah 90, verse 13. The steep path, and it's defined earlier in the thing as jihad, striving for God. The steep path is the freeing of a slave or giving food at a time of famine to an orphan near of kin or a needy person. Clinging to the dust while being one of those who believe and exhort one another in patience. And exhort one another to compassion. Those are the companions of the right. And those who disbelieve in our signs, they are the companions of the left. Unto them is a fire enclosed. On the whole, a lovely statement. And we've seen a lot in the Quran of the care for the orphan and the widow and the poor and the stranger. Surah 91, verse 9. Indeed, he prospers who purifies it, purifies the soul, and indeed, he fails who obscures it. He is indeed a failure who stunts it. Surah 92, also from Mecca, the study of Quran states, the central theme is one found in many of the shorter surahs. Human beings have diverse ends. Judgment, paradise as described, or hell as described. And verse 20 commends the person who seeks the face of the Lord, the Most High. Surely he will be content. Psalm 93 from Mecca, I'm quoting in full. These words, I'm told, came to Muhammad after an interval during which he received no words. And this is how it reads. By the morning brightness, and by the night when still, thy Lord has not forsaken thee, nor does he despise. And the hereafter shall be better for thee than this life, and surely the Lord will give unto thee, and thou shalt be content. Did he not find thee an orphan and shelter? Find thee astray and guide, and find thee in need and enrich. So as for the orphan, scorn not, and as for one who requests, repel not, and as for the blessing of the Lord, proclaim. I find that one of the most beautiful of the surahs, Surah 93. Surah 94, again quoted in full, so you can see they're very short, and they're going to get shorter. It's another very beautiful surah. Comfort is given to Muhammad at a time when he was being shunned and ridiculed. This is from the early period of Mecca. It reads, "Did we not expand for thee thy breast and lift from thee thy burden that weighed heavily upon thy back? And did we not elevate thy renown? For truly with hardship comes ease. Truly with hardship comes ease. So when thou art free, exert thyself and let thy desire be for your Lord." Surah 95 again is on judgment. And 96, recite in the name of thy Lord. I'm going to delay here on Surah 96. It begins, recite in the name of thy Lord. This appears to express Muhammad's first experience, according to the study Quran, the first experience of receiving what he experienced as words from God. So I want to remind you of the dates a bit to get you into the setting, and then I'm going to read to you from the study Quran on this surah. Muhammad was born in 570. Age 25, he married Khadija, who was 15 years his senior. In 610, so he's 40, he has his first vision. We'll be talking about that in a minute. I'm using the word vision. In 619, when he is 60 nearly, is that right? 50, sorry. When he's nearly 50, his wife died. They had 25 years of married life together. After that, a lot happens. All that business about his wives and the slave girl from the Coptic Christian, and it goes on and on and on. And he was allowed to have as many wives as he liked. That all happens after the death of Khadija. And I can't help believing there's some significance in that. In 623, when he was 53, that's when he fled Mecca to go to Medina. And that's year one of the Muslim calendar. In 627, after 4 years at Medina, he was victorious over his own Mecca tribe. And 3 years later, in 630, he actually entered Mecca as a victor. He died 2 years later, in 632. During that period at Medina, he led 27 military campaigns. So from a struggling, wanting to share his experiences with people as best he could in Mecca, we come to this last years of his life, effectively 10 years, when he lived as a warlord, really, securing and then advancing the cause of Islam. The print in this 2,000-year book is terribly small, I'm going to see if my eyes can handle it better. So. So they're talking about Surah 96. And it reads, according to the Prophet's wife, Aisha, quote, the first thing that began happening with the Messenger of God from the revelation were dreams that he would see in his sleep, dreams that came true. Well, she obviously got this second hand because she's not his wife at this stage. But he would not see any dream except that it would come to be, like the break of day in the morning. Then seclusion became beloved of him. He used to go to the cave of Mount Hira and devote himself to worship there for a number of nights, and would bring provisions. Then he would return to his wife, Khadija, and replenish his provisions for a similar number of nights. This continued until the revelation suddenly came to him while he was in the cave of Hira. Continues. The archangel, brackets Gabriel, came to him while he was in the cave and said, recite. We've just seen it. Recite. The messenger of God said, I replied, I'm not a reciter. Then he said, so he seized me and pressed me until I could no longer bear it. Then he released me, this is the angel Gabriel, and said, recite. And I replied, I'm not a reciter. Then he pressed me a second time until I could no longer bear it. Then he released me and said, recite. So I replied, I'm not a reciter. Then he pressed me a third time until I could no longer bear it. Then he released me and said, recite in the name of thy Lord who created. And the text goes on. Then he, the prophet, returned with these verses, that's Surah 96, and with his heart trembling until he reached Khadija and said, cover me, cover me. So they wrapped him up until his fear went away. Then he said to Khadija, what is wrong with me? And he told her what had happened and said, I fear for my soul. And she replied, never. By God, God will never disgrace you. You keep good relations with your relatives. You speak the truth. You help the poor and the destitute. You serve your guests generously, and you help the deserving who are afflicted by misfortune. There's no reason to doubt any of this. That's the kind of person he was. She then accompanied him to her cousin, Waraka ibn Nufal, who, during the period of ignorance in pre-Islamic Arabia, became a Christian and used to write the scriptures in Arabic. He would write from the Gospel in Hebrew his as much as God willed for him to write. He was then an old man and had lost his eyesight. Waraka answered, O my nephew, what have you seen? The messenger of God described what he saw, and Waraka, remember he's an old Christian, Waraka said, this is the nomos, from the Greek nomos, indicating a revealed law. This is the law that God sent to Moses. I wish I were young and could live until the time when your people will drive you out. And the messenger of God said, will they drive me out? And Waraka replied, yes, no man has come with something similar to what you have brought, but that he was treated with hostility and enmity. And if I should remain alive till that day, then I would firmly support you. The surah begins with this injunction to recite. So it seems to me, anyhow, from my reading and study, that Muhammad did have an extraordinary experience of the oneness of God, and that he was a very fine young man and had a very lovely wife who could kind of look after him, if you like. And here he is approaching his uncle, who's an ancient Christian, who asserts, according to Aisha, another wife, asserts that it's real what he's experiencing, so, but it will bring punishment and all the rest of it. To finish that, what happened when Khadija died, and what happened when the Muslim community became militarily powerful, I don't know what to make of all that. Surah 97, again quoted in full. Truly, we sent, this is again from Mecca, from that early period of struggle and not being sure of himself and yet having these extraordinary experiences. Truly, we sent it down, it is the Quran, in the night of power. And what shall apprise you of the night of power? The night of power is better than 1,000 months. The angels and the spirit descend therein by the leave of their Lord with every command. Peace it is until the break of dawn. Now, when I first read that, I couldn't make head or tail of it. Then I read the study Quran, which says there are over 40 interpretations of what is meant by the night of power. So it's clearly none of the Islamic scholars understand it either, or they debate it at great length. Surah 98, not sure where it comes from, reads, those who disbelieve among the people of the book, and you know who they are by now, and the idolaters, pagans, will not desist until the clear proof comes to them, a messenger from God, reciting scriptures purified wherein are books upright. Truly, the disbelievers among the people of the book and the idolaters are in the fire of hell. Sounds like Medina to me, but scholars aren't sure, so of course I'm not. Surah 99, again, its origin is debated. It speaks of the earthquake issuing in a day of judgment. Surah 100 from Mecca, God knows all that we do and will be judged on our submission. That's the word Islam. And Psalm 101 to 104, the only time I allowed myself to skip a few, they're all very short surahs and they're all about hell. So, I think we've had enough of that. Surah 105 from Mecca. In the year of Muhammad's birth, Abraha, the ruler of the Abyssinian kingdom in Yemen, attacked Mecca intending to destroy the Kaaba, but he had to abandon the attack. That seems to be the history behind that surah. Surah 106 speaks of God's protection of the Quraysh because of the presence in Mecca of the Kaaba. Surah 107, quoted in full, "Hast thou seen the one who denies religion? That is the one who drives away the orphan and does not urge feeding the indigent. So woe unto the praying who are heedless of their prayers, those who strive to be seen yet refuse small kindnesses." I can hear Jesus saying that. The words aren't exactly his, but the truth is, James will say it often. Surah 108 from Mecca, again quoted in full, "Truly we have bestowed abundant good upon thee, so pray to thy Lord and sacrifice. Truly thine enemy shall be the one without posterity." And Psalm 109, also from Mecca, quoted in full, "Say, O disbelievers, I worship not what you worship, nor are you worshippers of what I worship. Nor am I a worshipper of what you worship, nor are you worshippers of what I worship." Sounds like a repetition, but it is a repetition in the text. "Unto you, your religion, and unto me, mine." There's going to be no compromise in this beautiful final revelation that's come direct from God through Gabriel to Muhammad. Surah 110, quoted in full, "When God's help and victory come, and you see mankind entering God's religion in throngs, hymn the praise of thy Lord, and seek forgiveness from him, truly he is ever relenting." Psalm 111 from the early period in Mecca. That previous one is from Medina and is said to be one of his last revelations. But this is from Mecca. "May the hands of Abu Lahab..." It's either a B or an H, I can't tell from here. I think it's a B. An H, is it good? "May the hands of Abu Laha," one of Muhammad's opponents, "perish, and may he perish. His wealth avails him not, nor what he has earned. He shall enter a blazing fire, and his wife, carrier of firewood, upon her neck is a rope of palm fibre." Psalm 112 from Mecca, again in full, "Say, he, God, is one. God the eternal is sufficient unto himself. He begets not, nor was he begotten, and none is like unto him." And Surah 113, "Say, I seek refuge in the Lord of the daybreak, from the evil of what he has created, from the evil of the darkness when it enshrouds, from the evil of those who blow upon knots," some kind of malignant witchcraft carried out in the day, "and from the evil of the envier when he envies." And the final surah, Surah 114, reads, "Say, I seek refuge in the Lord of mankind, the King of mankind, the God of mankind, from the evil of the stealthy whisperer who whispers into the breasts of mankind, from jinn," those intermediary spirits, "and mankind." So that concludes. Not that there's a bit to come, yes. I want to put a little epilogue on the end, but we've looked as best I'm able to in this brief time at all the surahs of the Quran. And this is my final little, I'll call it a gift, in the hope that that's what it is, impressions or something I want to share to you at the end of our time together. As I say here, I've been working on this paper for 3 years. The paper itself is on my website. You go to my website and just click on Islam at the left and it'll all open up, as are all the talks or presentations. So I've been working on this for 3 years because I share the conviction that we must all contribute what we can to a better understanding of Christianity and Islam if our world is to enjoy peace and prosperity. I can only hope that my small contribution will be found helpful. By way of conclusion, I wish here to underline the main ideas that have come to me over these 3 years. Firstly, a philosophical point. I made it already on the first night, but may I repeat it? Nothing that we experience here has in itself sufficient reason to ground its existence. Everything we know, everything we sense and reflect on is dependent. The argument is one of St. Thomas's arguments for the existence of God, but I think a very sound one. There must exist a being that is self-sufficient and so not dependent. Otherwise, everything's depending on other things that are depending on. They must exist. And this is the being we have called God. That philosophical argument tells us nothing about God except that there must exist, if things are meaningful, a reality that is ultimately holding everything in existence. Fully comprehending this reality is beyond our capacity. We know that if reality is ultimately meaningful, this reality must exist, but we cannot define it. Any words we use to speak of the reality can at best point us towards it, which we talked about in the discussion earlier this morning. We can't comprehend the reality. We can either point in a direction that takes us away from it and dead ends, and that's what we call heresy, or we can point it in a direction that, as we go along it, helps make sense of it. And the direction we point to, of course, is Jesus. The Muslims point to the Quran. Since God holds everything in existence, we can deduce certain things about God from what we know about creation. People have intuited the presence of this mysterious reality in nature, in a mountain shrouded in cloud, in a grove of trees, in a spring gushing from the earth, in the sun or moon, in thunder and lightning in the night sky, and you could add everything to that. And the history of religion witnesses to this. There emerged in human consciousness an intuition, had to be tested, and it's still, in a way, hesitant. There emerged an intuition that ultimately everything is interconnected. That the spirit of the ocean and the spirit of the earth and the spirit of the sky are ultimately the one spirit, the one presence, the one creator that accounts for the existence of everything and sustains everything in being. The notion of monotheism was born, but how fragile it is. How many monotheists do you know? Am I really a monotheist? I would tick that box if you asked me. Am I really a monotheist? And most of the monotheists we see in our world say there's only one God and he's ours, not yours. Oh, that's hardly monotheism. It's illogical, it's kind of crazy, but it's common. So I like to think of St. Francis of Assisi as a monotheist, and from then on I'm only guessing. Jesus certainly was. Christians believe that it's Jesus whose humanity best reveals God and reveals God as love. Now that's stunning. And love is self-giving. And the whole of creation is seen through by Jesus and by us, his disciples, hopefully, as a self-giving of this Creator, this mysterious presence. Everything expresses it. It's essential that we humbly acknowledge that religious texts are human documents. I've said it 50 times. It's not a Muslim idea, but I pray that it will become a Muslim idea, and that might liberate them from the dominance of teachers who quote the Quran as locked in. We may cherish these texts as inspired by God, yes, because we find them inspiring. Especially significant here are the sacred writings of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I'm not limiting to that, but that's our topic. Because for many hundreds of years, they have continued to nourish people's lives. I didn't find the Quran very nourishing, except individual texts that surprised me, I must say, and I find. But if I'm looking for nourishment after today, I won't be going to the Quran. I'll be going where I've been trained to go, hopefully to Jesus, the New Testament, and the wonderful traditions that I've been privileged to be part of. There's a temptation for the followers of a religious tradition, any religious tradition, to think of their foundational text as coming direct from God. Lifted in this way above human authorship, the texts can be judged to avoid contextual analysis. If we're to contribute to the search for meaning, we must acknowledge this temptation and act against it. Such is our propensity for self-deception that we need each other's help if we're going to maintain the humility that's necessary in all that we say about God. And that diagram that I gave you earlier in the last it's very clear from Christian scriptures that they emerged from a believing community as a fruit of faith, hope and love and life and all the rest of it. That's very clear. It's not as clear at all from the Hebrew scriptures, though scholars now see it clearly, and it's not at all clear from the Quran. I pray that this paper may assist Christians to appreciate the contribution Islam has made to our search for meaning. Its fidelity to Muhammad's central mystical experience of the oneness of God. Its highlighting, however imperfectly, of God's compassion and readiness to forgive. Its call to prayer, its care for orphans, for the poor and strangers. And I pray also that this paper may assist Muslims to find these same values in Christianity. Islam had its beginnings in a violent world, which helps explain the inclusion in the Quran of instructions purporting to come from God to use every means, including violence, to protect and propagate Islam, the religion of truth. Jesus, too, lived in a violent world. His response was to reveal God as love and to teach us to love our neighbours, including our enemies. My prayer is that Christians will learn, including me of course, that we will learn to follow Jesus in this, and that Muslims will see the statements of the Quran that support violence as a 7th century response that's understandable in its historical context, but that doesn't represent the will of God. Freed from this idea, Islam will be free to make its contribution to our search for meaning and to the building of peace in this, what Pope Francis calls, our common home. I'm nearly finished, so I'm going to read to you one of the loveliest texts in the New Testament, a plea from St. Paul to the Christian community of Philippi, which he visited 4 times, and he seems to have had no trouble with them. They seem to be a place he went to rest and be comforted, whereas many of the other communities were very difficult. Well, this is what he writes to the Philippians. The end of his life, he's writing most probably from Rome, ready to face the judgment of the emperor. And he writes, "If there's any appeal in Christ, any consolation from love, any communion in the Spirit, any movements of compassion and feelings of love, make my joy complete. Be of the same mind, having the same love, being of one soul and one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition. Don't strive after or seek to find your value in things that are worthless, but in humility regard others above yourselves, so that not everyone is focused on themselves, but each is looking to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus." And I think it's appropriate to give the last word to the Quran. So I'm quoting from a surah that I just read not so long ago, but I'll read it again, Surah 93, and then Surah 1, the favourite surah of the Muslim people. Surah 93, in its completion, reads, "By the morning brightness, and by the night when still, thy Lord has not forsaken thee, nor does he despise. And the hereafter shall be better for thee than this life. And surely the Lord will give unto thee, and thou shalt be content. Did he not find thee," these Muhammad, "did he not find thee an orphan and shelter? Did he not find thee astray and guide? And find thee in need and enrich? So as far as for the orphan, scorn not. And as for one who requests, repel not. And as for the blessing of the Lord, proclaim." And Surah 1, which we read obviously days ago, in its completion reads, "In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, the compassionate, the merciful, master of the day of judgment. Thee we worship, and from thee we seek help. Guide us upon the straight path, the path of those whom thou hast blessed." And I'll conclude with a piece of music. "Always loving you." So that's a picture of you and a Muslim walking a path together. At least that's how I'm mentioning it for now. And God is always loving you. That icon, as you know, is the beloved disciple, unnamed in the text of the fourth gospel, leaning on the breast of Jesus, learning who God is through the heart. So our prayer for each other could be that, well, that's meant, we're all meant to be the beloved disciple. So is every Muslim. And our mission, however, through love, there's no other way, our mission must be to invite any Muslim, any Jew, any Hindu, any Buddhist to lean there on the breast of Jesus and come to know, bring all their gifts, all they know, all their history, all of that. Bring it all, don't leave it, but bring it all and then see what remains when we get, when we lean on the breast of Jesus as the beloved disciple. Because he is the way, the truth and the life, and he will show us, if we allow him, who God really is.